All right, we just about finished up. We looked at a few of the minor judges, which really we have Jephthah's, the end of Jephthah's story in the first half of chapter 12, verses 1 through 7, and then verses 8 through 15, we have these three minor judges. So we saw as Jephthah's story came to a close, quite a sad ending for a sad life, as the last thing we really find about him, he reigned as judge for 6 years in Israel, and right before his life ended, he had this big tussle with Ephraim where 42,000 men died as a result of their arrogance and their pride. So we come to a few minor judges after him, and we talk just a little bit about them. But let's go ahead and pick up and read verses 8 through 15, have one more question, and then we'll jump into chapter 13. Judges 12, verse 8. Now Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel after him. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters, whom he gave in marriage outside the family, and he brought in 30 daughters from outside for his sons. He judged Israel for 7 years. And then Ibzan died and was buried in Bethlehem. Now Elon the Zebulunite judged Israel after him, and he judged Israel 10 years. Then Elon the Zebulunite died and was buried at Ajalon in the land of Zebulun. Now Abdon the son of Hillel the Pirathonite judged Israel after him, and he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys, and he judged Israel 8 years. And then Abdon the son of Hillel died and was buried at Pirathon in the land of Ephraim in the hill country of the Amalekites. All right, last question we got to, I believe it's number 7. And there may be crickets and there may be some good responses on this, just depending how much time you give into consideration of this question. Do you see any lessons? Do you learn anything from the minor judges here? These three men, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. Peace?
And then
you see peace there somewhere?
Chapter 13, the next thing it says that they did evil. So
okay.
I'm not sure if that means they did evil during while they were reigning or if they turned to evil.
Well, you know, that's an interesting contrast you make. You see that it just says they judged Israel. They judged Israel. They judged Israel. And normally, you're right. When you go back and you read about those earlier judges, whenever they judged Israel, it says there was peace in the land. That's how each chapter concluded. Or there was peace in the land for 40 years. The land saw peace for 80 years. But you come over here, you don't read about peace. You just see they judged Israel. They judged Israel. They judged Israel. And so what we're seeing is kind of a digression, not just this cycle, but a downward spiral, if you will, where the status of Israel has grown worse. And you're right, we're about to start over in chapter 13, where they're again going to do evil in the sight of the Lord.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is not so much, I don't really know what I'm trying to say, but they weren't like oppressed by somebody.
Okay. The land had peace in the sense they weren't at war, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But we're not told of any rest that they had specifically. Well, what would happen? The judge would come along. He would free Israel from the oppressor. And then it would say they had rest and the land had rest for 40 years, or the land had rest for 80 years. Or
and then the next thing would happen, they would do evil.
Mm-hmm.
And God would send the punisher.
Right. Now, you're right. I think perhaps the judge brought peace as he governed for however long it was he had, but we're not told as a result of his governing that there was peace in the land after. You know, that's what all the previous judges brought. It says after they freed Israel from their oppressors, they had peace for 40 years, 80 years, however long it was. But these guys just judge Israel for a period of time. And we get over here to chapter 13, we're going to find out once again they get themselves back into the same mud and mire that they had before. Tommy? Okay.
If you total up all those years, I think I came up with 31 years.
Okay.
Of no conflict. There's not a lot recorded about it. But you do, in the past, like you talked about, you had one judge, and then when they passed on, there would be a period of peace and no trials and everything, and then they'd fall away. But this time you had three or four back to back to back, you know, with no time in between. So, and then
right. And yeah, I kind of, like I said, I think I brought this out last week where we talked about the digression where you've got the first three judges, Othniel, Ehud, Barak, or Deborah. And about them, it tells about the good things they did. And they contrast with Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. And although they judged Israel, those latter three judged Israel, the effects and the negativity and the immorality that was just a part of their judging and their time as judge was very prominent. And you didn't have that with the first three. So you are right. You do bring out an important point. And this is one of the observations I made. You said there's not a lot said here about these three judges. And it really is a scratch in our head and wondering. And one of the things I learned, I walk away with, just because a story is not told does not mean that it's not important. You're right. For some reason, God saw fit to bring up these three men. And we refer to them as minor judges simply because of there's not much information provided about them versus very detailed stories for Othniel and Ehud and the various other major judges. We make that distinction. The distinction is not on the importance, but rather the information that we have about them. And to me, this really says a lot about Christians that work behind the scene, because the church is made up of all kind of people. It's made up of people who have a very public job, you might say, the minister, the elders, the song leaders, the people that lead prayer, that wait on the table. But that's not the only part of the church. Very important to the sustenance of the church is the Christians that work behind the scenes. And I think sometimes if we're not careful, we can get it in our head that it's only those public roles that are of greater importance, and everything else is just not as important. And someone may say, well, if I can't be an elder or a preacher or a deacon or a song leader or something like that, Bible class teacher, well, then there's nothing else worth doing. That's completely and utterly false. And that, I mean, you may have, I feel like that's one of the things that I learned as I read through here. But I can tell you, just having been in other congregations, who I appreciate as much as anybody else. And it's parents that come with young children. And the few times that I've had to watch Annabelle during a Bible class, I realized you don't always get a lot out of it if you're watching kids. And if you get more than one, and it really distracts you from the things that are being taught. And I appreciate parents with young children that come because they know their children need to be there and they know they need to be there. And people don't get praised for that, but I think that's a very important thing. The members that show up, you know, we have the ones who rain or shine, it doesn't matter. If the doors are open, they're going to be there. Now, they may leave as soon as the services are over, and they may not get up and lead prayer and lead songs or participate in some observable events, but every time the door opens, they're going to be there. You can just count on them to be there. I appreciate people like that. And the ones that maintain the grounds, the one that keep the building clean, we're not up here patting them on the back, but it's a very essential part of what allows us to worship comfortably, and I appreciate them. The ladies that are downstairs right now, teaching the Bible classes, instructing the young minds, don't know what could be more important than that particular task. And I know some of them, as I've seen the products of the time that they spend preparing for class to teach, you know, the handful of kids that they have, they probably spend as much or more time than I do preparing for class. And that's a testament to their commitment for developing these young minds that are going to serve God. They don't get patted on the back, but that is essential in a church being successful. And the ladies, and the ones who call and check on the sick and the infirm and who aren't able to get out and make house visits and go see the ones who are stuck at home and cook food and write cards and make phone calls, nobody sees that. And they don't get the public praise that other jobs might. But what would you have if you didn't have those members? You know, you'd be left with an empty church, and there's only be a handful of us here, and we'd really be limited in the good that we're able to accomplish. And so that's one of the things that I appreciate. Those are some of the things that I appreciate. And people that might just spend time praying for the church here, for its leadership and for its growth. You don't always see the person that does that, but God sees it. You go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 22 and 23. Let me read just real briefly from there. I think we can kind of get things backward if we're not careful sometimes about what the best role to play is in the church. In 1 Corinthians 12, 22 and 23, Paul says, as he's talking about the church and using this analogy of the body, he says, on the contrary, it's much truer that the members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary, and those members of the body on which we deem less honorable, on these we bestow more abundant honor, and our less presentable members become much more presentable. God honors the people that play in those behind-the-scenes roles, if you will, and God will honor them. And so if that's a role you play in the church, don't ever think that your role is of lesser importance than the preacher or the elders, because every one of us is important, and every one of us have the responsibility to serve the Lord in whatever way is possible. God sees that, and God will honor them. That's one of the things I walk away with from reading these minor judges. Just because a story's not told doesn't mean that it's not important. Does anyone want to add anything before I make a couple more observations? The Bible's purpose is not to tell about every Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon, these minor judges that we came across. And the fact that we see so little about them tells us where our focus needs to be. And oftentimes as I'm reading through stories like this, it's stories like Jephthah or stories like Gideon, stories like Samson that I get caught up in. And who I oftentimes get so caught up in is the individual, the Samson or the Gideon or the Jephthah. But these three judges here are rather obscure. And it brings us back to the point and the intention of the Bible. The Bible is not about man. The Bible is theocentric, meaning that God is at its center. And if you think back to Gideon, he's got three chapters, and we find out about Gideon's fear and his initial doubting and his action and his attitude and his personality, and it's his story, so it would seem. But if you're not careful, you can get lost in the details of what the tool, what the vessel that God is using is doing. And we're told about Gideon's fear, and we're told about Gideon's inadequacies so that God can be exalted. So that we see Gideon winning a battle against a ridiculous Midianite army with 300 men. We're not told about that because of Gideon's prowess, and so that we might say, wow, Gideon, what faith. But rather so we see how mighty God is who delivered his people through the weakness and the shortcomings of man. And so we don't need to lose sight of the tool as we're studying our Bibles. We need to remember that it's God who's at its center. It's God who is working that we need to be paying attention to. And rather than focusing solely on the individual that God uses, we need to be looking at the God who is bringing those actions about and accomplishing His will. And then lastly, as you kind of read through this text here, you have a little bit of a repetition. And we're told about the death of the other judges. Told about Gideon and Ehud and Othniel and all of them dying, but it doesn't really stand out to us in contrast because you got a bunch of text and a lot of things happening in between. But you come over here, verse 10, Ibzan died and was buried in Bethlehem. Verse 12, Elon died and was buried in Bethlehem. Verse 15, Abdon died and was buried in Bethlehem. Verse 7, we just find out he died, he died, he died. And when you see it in that kind of concentration, it kind of forces you to look a little more closely at it. Because we're told in great detail about the death of some of Israel's leaders. If you think about Moses, how God took him up on Mount Nebo and showed him all of the land of Canaan and said, this is going to be with the promised land. This is going to be the land I give the people. And how he died on Mount Nebo. And we're told how he was buried by God there. And we're told about Joshua and how he was taking his body after he died. And he was buried in Ephraim. And we're told how the judges were buried and the kings were buried. And when you're forced to see it, though, in such quick succession, you just can't miss the point that there's an obituary somewhere with my name on it. You know, I read a quote, and it says, "Death, the lot of men, at last claims his due of the great and the good. And whatever else we may hear of any man, we're sure to hear one thing, that he died." There's no escaping it. You might prolong it. You might rush headfirst into it. But if Christ doesn't return, then there is no preventing it. And so we would do well to live with that thought, as unpleasant as it may be, in mind. And secondly, although God's earthly leaders die, we have a leader God has raised up that will live forever. Hebrews 7:23-25. The former priests, on the other hand, existed in great number because they were prevented by death from continuing. But Jesus, on the other hand, because he continues forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Therefore, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. And so contrasting those human rulers that come and rule for a season, God has raised up one who stands at his right hand, who always lives to make intercession. And that is his son, Jesus. Anyone have any other comments or questions they'd like to bring to our attention before we move on to chapter 13? Okay. I think of Abraham. You know how Abraham, he purchased the cave of Machpelah whenever Sarah died? And for a long time, for his family, wanted to be buried at the, the cave of Machpelah. And when that's where he wanted to be laid to rest. Remember, I think it's, wasn't it Joseph that wanted to, well, I know Joseph wanted to be buried I think with his family. And we're told that he rested with his fathers, that phrase is used. And you see, there seemed to be some kind of royal tomb after David died, where the kings of Judah, that successive lineage in genealogy was carried out. I think most of them were buried with their forefathers. And you kind of have here, you don't have the same, and maybe the reason for that is, Steve, you don't have the same unity that you did under the kings, where, you know, Israel and Judah have for a time been united, and you have a specific lineage. Rather, you just have God raising up a man here from Ephraim, and God raising up a man from Zebulun, and God raising up a man from somewhere else. And it seems like they each want to be buried in where their home tribe was. And so that may have been why they were put in various places. I don't know. So, good observation. All right, well, let's go ahead and move on to chapter 13. Those questions were back there Wednesday night, and they're also available online if you want to grab those. I didn't import my slideshow up here, so we're going to have to go without our slides for the first little while. So that may make our study a little bit more challenging. One little thing I've added, and it's just for the benefit of anybody that wants it, don't feel obligated to grab it and read it. It's bad enough that you got to listen to me. I don't know much why you'd want to read something that I've written, but I've added chapter summaries for the Bible study. So there's a chapter summary back there on the back table for chapter 13 that just kind of highlights some of the things, the events of chapter 13. I know sometimes my questions, you're probably wondering, where does he think that up? And maybe that'll bring a little bit of clarity to what I'm thinking about a chapter, or what I read about, what I think when I'm reading a particular verse that would cause maybe what seems like an off-the-wall question. So let's come to chapter 13. Chapters 13, I believe it's chapters 13 through 16, are a unit. It was chapters 13 through 16 are going to tell the story of a man named Samson. Probably, to me, the most interesting judge whenever I was growing up. And it's interesting to think about all of these characters because they had their flaws and they had their strengths. Were these guys heroes or were these guys bad examples? And I think that's something that we can ask about each individual one. They did good things, but they all did bad things just about, it seems, too. Especially that's what we're going to see filling Samson's life. And it may seem he did more bad than good. So let's look at Judges 13. And we're actually not going to be introduced to Samson until the very end of the chapter. But we'll talk a little bit about why that might be along the way. Let's start by reading verses 1 through 7. Brother Barker, would you read Judges 13, 1 through 7 for us, please? Yes, sir. Then the woman came and told her husband, saying, "A man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of an angel of God, very awesome. And I did not ask where he came from, nor did he tell me his name. But he said to me, 'Behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and now you shall not drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing, for the boy shall be a Nazarite.'" All right, here I believe is more evidence of not just the cycle of sin, but rather this digression. And so the first question we've got, which I don't know if you grabbed this or not, and I apologize, I can't put them on the screen. Are you able to identify anything that might point toward a digression rather than a cycle of sin that Israel is participating here in the first verse? Tommy?
Be a
Okay, right. That's one of the observations I made. First oppression was 8 years by the Mesopotamians, and it says they cried out and God raised up Othniel. Then it was the Moabites for 18 years, they cried out and God raised up Ehud. Canaanites for 20 years, they cried out and God raised up Barak and Deborah. Midianites for 7 years, they cried out and God raised up Gideon. And we come over here to chapter 10, we just read about Jephthah. The Ammonites and the Philistines oppressed them for 18 years, they cried out and God gave them Jephthah. First verse here, though, says that they did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. Did you notice a different response compared to all of the others? Israel's response to their oppression?
They're not crying out.
And all of the other previous instances, are one, as Tommy identified, it's twice as long as their previous any of the previous oppressions that they've suffered. And secondly, they haven't cried out in response to the oppression. 40 years of subjection to the Philistines, why not cry out to God? And I think that's because we're seeing somewhat of a spiritual digression. You go over to chapter 15 and verse 11 and you get a little bit of insight to the attitude that Israel has toward their oppression. Well, you read the second part of that verse. We see 3,000 men of Judah, and this is after Samson has begun to deliver Israel. And as he does so, the people say to him in verse 11 of chapter 15, "Do you not know that the Philistines are rulers over us?" And so, in a sense, they have just succumbed to the oppression. They're under bondage for 40 years. They got used to it, and they didn't cry out to God anymore. They didn't ask for deliverance anymore. And so, you're not just looking at the cycle, but you're looking at this downward spiral, I believe. What do you think the danger is? Dave, were you going to make a comment?
Why do I think that is?
I just think their digression is growing worse and worse. If you think about two or three generations ago in the world in which we live, or maybe even further than that, you think back to the early 1900s, how there were certain things, certain sins, certain immoral acts that were just not participated in. And as you think about how each generation raises children, and then they raise children, and they raise children, as you progress down through the generations, just my observation seems to be that they're becoming more and more ungodly. Has anyone else noticed that? I mean, things are tolerated today that, you know, 50 years ago, you'd be ran out of town. You'd be strung up for some of the stuff that's happening today that we just become so unashamed of, and we're so forward with our immorality and our sexuality and all of those things. You just see this moral digression even in the last 50 years. And even in my lifetime, I've been able to see it as well. I just think you start that slope of getting further from God, which we saw them doing. I think you just gradually get worse and worse and worse. And I think that's what's kind of happened here, that they've gotten used to the bondage. They've gotten used to the oppression. And I think the lack of leadership that was strong with Joshua and Moses and the elders that ruled during the day of Joshua, I think that's got a lot to do with it as well. Anybody else have thoughts on that?
It wasn't so much the oppression of the Philistines. They had fell into their lifestyle.
Sure. The Philistines had just about subverted them. They had worshiping in the false gods and going after intermarrying, and that's what we're going to see Samson doing a little bit later on. So the Philistines were the ruling nation, and Israel just kind of fell in line with them. Very. You're right. He's going to use an interesting guy. Johnny, were you going to say something?
You know, they were not a united group. The Israelites weren't. They were a bunch of tribes at the time. And so it'd be easier to come in, you know, like domino one at a time and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
4 years here between what we saw last. Anyway, it's just a, you know, it's just one of these things that happen. Human nature,
yep.
You just get accustomed to more and more and more.
But it didn't happen, you made a good point, it didn't happen overnight. It, you know, Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Good judges, nothing negative mentioned. The land had rest 40 years. The land had rest 80 years. But then you get over Gideon, leads them to idolatry. He delivers them, but he leads them into idolatry. Jephthah delivers them from the enemies, but you know, gives up his daughter, loses his daughter, kills, nearly exterminates the Ephraimites. Samson, going to find out some, about some of his moral struggles. Tommy, were you going to say something?
No, just pretty much what everybody was saying. Same problem.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've often heard preachers say, you know, it seems like the world is moving further and further from God's word, and the church, if it's careful, can fall into the same mistake. Even though we may fall later into the cycle that the world is in as they move more away from the morality and the standard prescribed in the Bible, if we're not careful, and that's the importance of what the New Testament calls steadfastness. And standing on the teachings and standing on the principles and refusing to budge when the world gives way and the world goes one way. It's not just following slowly behind them, but it's standing on God's word and refusing to get, budge off of that. Dave?
You see that very thing in Paul's letter to Corinthians. Right? Their inability to blush. 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 Their inability to recognize an act that should be shameful. And so even back then, I mean, we're talking first century Christians.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, that's why we're told those stories, right? So that the same things that happened to them don't happen to us. And as spiritual Israel, God's church today, we've got to make sure that we stand firmly on God's word. You see, in all of this, and John Collier, if he's here, I know he'd say something. It all goes back to the fact they compromised. They didn't kill the Canaanites like God told them, completely and utterly do it. It starts with compromise, and it snowballs. And this is a snowball effect. It seems small at the moment, then it starts rolling down the hill and builds and builds and builds and builds, and you end up with something like this where all of a sudden you're sitting in sin and you look around, and that's just the way it is. Johnny?
We get in this attitude of God doesn't care about that. And, you know, it feels over time. A good example to me is just watch nearly any commercial on TV or start watching commercials on TV and ask, did that commercial have been on TV 40 years ago?
It's just this digression. We're falling into the same way. You look back, David mentioned the church at Corinth, and there are some things, if we think we're bad, Roman society was significantly worse. And, you know, we say we can't imagine it getting any worse, but it did. And we've just got to make sure that we don't fall prey to that. But it's a digression, and it doesn't always, you don't always see the end in sight whenever you open up the door and you let just a little bit of compromise in. But then pretty soon what you find out is you got a problem that's completely out of control. And so it starts small, but it becomes something great. And I think we're seeing the result of the snowball effect that started way back when, whenever Israel compromised just a little bit, and it started rolling down the hill, and it's built up to something pretty terrible now. So let me kind of change, as we've identified Israel's spiritual digression, let's make a little bit of modern application. What's the danger of allowing sin to become such a routine part of your life? And I ask that question because Israel allowed bondage to become a routine part of their life, just to the point they didn't cry out to God anymore. What's the danger of allowing sin to become such a routine part of your life?
We get in bondage to sin.
Okay. Romans 6:16, whichever one we choose to obey, you know, to that one it's our master, to that one we're in bondage. And it can either be to sin leading to death or to God leading to righteousness. And so when you allow yourself to participate in sin so much so that it becomes a part of your life, you wouldn't place yourself in bondage to it. David?
To me, it goes to conditioning of the conscience. I mean, when it's scarred over, there's no tender area that can be affected. It's, everything goes. I mean, I'm reminded of Max Licato. He used to be a Church of Christ preacher in San Antonio. He made a sign of numbers in the community. It would be better to change it to community church. And just one thing after another, now he's on TV all the time. He's one of the...
Was that a compromise of truth, it sounds like, in favor of money, numbers, attendance, and all of those other things? And it's a slow process sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't just happen. You don't just wake up and find yourself there. But you start tolerating a little bit, and It just kind of gets away from you. But if you allow sin to become such a routine part of your life, and this is going back to the illustration that they were commanded to destroy all of the Canaanites, you can't leave a few Canaanites. Because you see what happens if you leave a few Canaanites. And it's the same way with sin in our life. If sin is the Canaanites, we're commanded to not just get most of them out of the way, but all of them, destroy them all. You see the result, what happens. If you find yourself in bondage and you allow sin to become a regular part of your life, then you stop crying out to God. That's what happened here. They stopped crying out to God. You quit asking God to deliver you. You know, and we've probably all been there before where you're struggling with a particular sin and you're asking God for His help and for His deliverance, and it just seems like you're having trouble breaking that cycle. If you allow it to continue to exist and you just quit asking God for help, you quit trying to fight it. You don't try to stop sinning. We'll get you, Miss, just a minute, Miss Johnny. But you don't try to stop sinning. And rather than expecting blessings, you learn to live with the pain. And you forget what it's like to be free. Miss Johnny? It's the small things, and like I said, if Satan 50 years ago would have tried to introduce the things that he has brought into the world today, such as open and blatant homosexuality and abortion to the degree that is carried out now, if he would have tried to implement that all at once, it would have failed. But it started with something smaller. It started with the breakdown of the home. It started with divorce and cohabitation before marriage. And adultery got to be where, rather than being condemned, it was idolized. And you just had this digression. And he doesn't bring in the end result. And maybe we haven't even seen the end result even now. But we're working our way in that direction, it seems. The only way to stop it is to stop and take a stand and bring everything back to God's Word. And that's what we've got to do. So we'll pick up with the same series of verses next week, looking at question two. So if you get those questions and be ready for our discussion next week, I thank everyone for their participation in our class.